Hello everybody, and welcome back. My name is Michael McDonald, and I'm going to take some time today to talk to you about something that's really a big passion of mine, and that's designing great games for the Windows Store. So let's go ahead and get started and have a little chat about what makes designing games for the Windows Store so amazing. Windows 8 has reach. The one amazing thing about developing games for the Windows Store is you have the advantage of being able to target a lot of different technologies and platforms all at once. We have tablets that have touch and sensors built into them. We have laptops with high resolution screens, PCs with amazing power. And we can really leverage all this to design some really amazing user experiences in our games. So throughout this presentation, I'm going to go through each one of them, highlight some of the key points, and kind of give you a feeling of how you can leverage this to help improve your user's experience overall. Okay, some key features in Windows 8 are, well, first of all, the one thing that everyone's going to notice right off the top is the live tiles. Live tiles can really help engage your audience and keep your users informed without actually having to launch the game. So one thing that you can do is you can put scores up there, you can put achievements, you can put challenges, you can even put invitations from other players. So it's a really good way to drive the user experience without the user actually being inside the game. Make sure you make this really, you know, bright and colorful. Draw the eyes into it. So that's one major thing you'll notice right off the bat. Another thing that I really like is the share and device contracts. With the share and device contracts, it really helps open up your game and app to the web and other devices that are already on the Windows 8 platform. So you could do things like share with Facebook, share with Twitter. It's a really neat feature, and we'll go into a little more depth about that after. We also have support for different input methods. You can use touch, you can use pen, you can use keyboards, mouse, and of course gamepads. So we'll talk a little bit about how to use all these different input methods and how to leverage them for your game. Sensors, this is really exciting. You've got things like light sensors, gyroscopes, accelerometers, you've got location devices like GPS. So we can really use all this to expand the experience of the game and allow the users to really do things that they wouldn't expect in most games, right? So we'll talk about a little bit about that too. Form factors and views. Okay, so this is great. You've got tablets to large LCDs, right? So you have a variety of tablets that have different screen resolutions and sizes. You've got LCDs that are just absolutely huge with, you know, beyond HD now. So that's something that we really need to take into consideration when we're designing our game is what do we expect the player to be playing this on, and kind of build into it so that they have the ability to switch from different form factors and views. One other thing that's coming out and becoming a little more popular now is the game controllers with screens on them, or tablets being used as a secondary screen or a different view for the video game. So that's something that's really nice to play around with and possibly leverage in your game. And then, of course, there's the Windows Store. This is like the developer's best friend. It gives us great opportunities. It really lets us get out there and distribute, promote, and get our games out into the marketplace. It's built so that you can get feedback from your audience, and little things like making in-game app purchases. Like, it makes it so much easier to do that with the Windows Store. We'll go into a little more depth about that in a bit, but it's a really nice feature that I've used personally in a couple of my games is the limited free trials feature. So we'll talk about that as well. The big thing is I'm gonna go through all this and really show you how we can use these features and how they affect and the design and development of our game as we get started. Okay, our best at statement. This is basically, can be summed up as, what makes your game stand out from the rest? What can you do better than any other game? What makes your game unique? So a best ad statement for a game like Cannonball would be Cannonball is best ad providing users with a simple and exciting game that allows them to create music by guiding a ball through platforms and collecting coins. It's really important that you do this before you start designing your game. Sit down and think to yourself, what is my game going to be best at? You know, and that's really going to drive your development as you move forward. It's going to help you make decisions about your strategy moving forward. Things like, do I need tilt? Do I need touch? Does it use a camera? All these things can really be answered with your best at statement. You know, am I going to be best at tilt controls for a marble maze game? Something along those lines. So it's really important to take a look at this and sit down and think it through before you get started. Okay, live tiles, secondary tiles, and notifications. So we talked about this a little bit in a previous slide there, was about the live tiles and really how they draw the player's eye in. It's really important that you have your branding there as well. Make it fit your game, make it bubbly, make it bright. This is your gateway to your game. You want this to be what stands out immediately. So if you take a look at the image I've got there on screen, you'll see that there's a high score being presented for the cannonball, as well as the current treasure limit. So they're giving the users information about the game before the game's even launched. This is really useful for games that have multiplayer, for instance. You could use the live tile to display notifications about someone's turn. Like, so if it's a turn-based game and it's my turn, it's going to pop up and say, it's your turn, right? And you can go ahead and click in there and play the game through. Other things like high scores, for instance. If my best friend beats my high score, I want to know. So a good place to put that would be your live tile. It'll pop up and say, you know, your latest high score has just been beaten. And it's a nice way to keep the users engaged without having to constantly launch the game to see, you know, where am I in the standings, or what achievements do I have left, or have I gotten yet. So you can really use this to your advantage. In this case, they're using the wide tile. There's also the smaller tiles. So you can see whatever fits best. Make sure you plan for both. And make that available to the user, because a lot of times people will zoom them and shrink them to whatever fits best on their screen. Okay. Splash screens and progress controls. Now this is very important. This is the first thing that a player is going to see when they launch your game. You want to make sure it's branded. It shows off maybe some highlights of the game, some animation, or the characters. So in this case, on the screen we have Skulls of the Shoguns as one of our templates, and then of course the Pirates Love Daisies loading screen. So what you'll notice about these is they're very bright, they're branded very well, there's not too much going on, but in the case of the Pirates Love Daisies screen, it's showing you that you know that it's still working on something. It says loading. So that's very important. If your game's going to take more than, say, 3 seconds to load up, make sure you provide the user with a progress bar. So it shows them that the game's not locked up. This is also very important when switching from a cutscene, say, to or levels. If it's going to take more than, say, half a second to load the cutscene or load the next level, make sure you provide the user some sort of feedback so they know that the app hasn't crashed. The last thing you want is some user exiting your game because they think it's crashed when all it's doing is loading. So that's definitely something to keep in mind, and is definitely a best practice in my opinion. So layout navigation. Layout navigation is very, very important to games. You don't want to have your user spending a lot of time scrolling through menu systems, you know, digging through complex and unwieldy systems to find out where they need to go immediately. Pardon me. So one thing you'll notice about this one here, Skull of the Shogun, is very simplistic, but everything is right there for you to see. So even if it's rich and complex, or it's basic and simple, you want to make sure that it's really easy for the user to navigate. Don't bury options and bury achievement screens and stuff like that and make them click through multiple things. They're not going to enjoy the experience, and it's going to detract from your overall game. A lot of options are used in the navigation, so like you might want to put your options in there. You might want to have an achievement screen, maybe a leaderboard, multiplayer lobbies. In some cases, I've seen games not even use a menu screen and just launch right into the game. It really depends on what you're doing. So when you design, when you start your design process, really sit down and think, how much information do I need to present to the user right away? What are the types of things that they're going to want to do immediately when they get into the game? That's important because you want that to be the first experience that they have. You don't want them to come in and you know have to click through 7 different things just to launch the game. So we'll go into detail a little bit about that, and I'll actually demo Skulls of the Shogun so you can see how their menu system works. And this actually brings up a good point. This is basically, when you start designing, you want to think about what pattern fits my game best. And when it comes to menu design and that, you want to think, what kind of system do I want to use for my particular situation? So we'll go ahead and we'll take a look at a couple here. Two of the major ones are hierarchical pattern and flat pattern. So we're going to go into each one independently. Let's take a look at the hierarchical pattern first. Sorry. This pattern is really good for showing everything up front. It puts all the content in front of the users immediately. So your users feel like they're getting the complete experience at once. You can have sections for, say, level choosing, new games, continuing old ones. You can have sections for showing achievements and friend activity. And you can do all this by putting it all on one horizontal panning screen. So this is really good for games that have a lot of different options or a lot of secondary experiences. One of the things that you could do with this pattern is you could actually brand each one of the sections. So say I click on a level, you could actually have it branding, like changing the background to match that level. So the user gets that kind of feeling like it's specialized to each section, right? That's important. It kind of draws the player in. It gives them a little bit more feeling of completeness. One thing about this design is, depending on your game, of course, but you might always want to include something like a back button that'll bring you right back to this hub. So if I'm in the middle of playing the game, I can click on this back button and it'll take me right back to the hub. Maybe I can check my achievements or something like that. It's a really good idea to include that with this design. Now, the one thing that this the hierarchical design really works well with is a thing called semantic zoom. So, because you have a lot of choices when it comes to that pattern, you have a lot of scrolling issues. Like, you're going to be scrolling from side to side to see other categories. So what semantic zoom does is it allows you to zoom out and see all the categories at once. This makes it a lot faster for you to navigate through your system and makes it easier for the players to find what they're looking for. So you could pinch out and zoom out. In this case on the screen, you could see that it has game themes, awards, leaderboards, that. And then I could go right in and say select achievements, and I can zoom right in on those achievements. So it's one easier way of letting them navigate, so they're not constantly scrolling from side to side trying to find what they're looking for. So it's definitely something that you want to include when you're using that pattern. Okay, the other pattern that's really popular is called the flat pattern. The flat pattern keeps the gameplay front and center. it's great for branding your game, because you're seeing all that right in front of you. It's minimalistic, but it can be rich with information. So as you're seeing right here in the game, Tankster, you have everything up on screen at once. You can see the interaction with the game, and you have, like, you know, your invitations to match, or to a match, or in this case, you know, it's pointing out that you have your turns available in one of the matches. So you can get a lot of information across the player, but it's not, you know, it's not like it's not all over the place. It's not in a list. It's not, there's no scrolling involved. It's really good for putting all the content and functionality up front. So one of the other things that I really like about it is you can kind of funnel your players through settings as well, right? You know, join match, and then it'll go to another screen that'll allow you to pick different settings for that match. So you're basically having the player funnel through the steps that they need to start the game without feeling like they have to go clicking through a bunch of menus. This can be great for games that don't have other standalone experiences. It's really good for the games that are more or less about that particular interaction. It's not about, you know, connecting with friends or you know, having side games and stuff like that in it. One thing to point out, though, about app layout considerations is you want to maintain a single scrolling direction. Don't mix and match horizontal and vertical views. For example, top score list. That would be displayed vertical, so you'll be scrolling from top to down a lot in that. So one way you can take that out of the equation is wrap it. Set it as columns, so you have one list and then the next. That way the player's not scrolling constantly. And if you feel like there is too much scrolling, one good way of getting around that is, again, using semantic zoom. So if you go through it and you're like, you know what, I'm scrolling too much to see the high score table, why not give it a semantic zoom, let people pinch out, or pinch it and see all of it at once in more of a zoomed form. So those are the two patterns. I want to take some time now and actually show you these patterns in use. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to fire up a couple of games here. First, I'm going to fire up Skulls of the Shogun and show you how they implemented their menu system and their loading screen and whatnot. So the first thing I want to show you here, actually, is the live tiles. If you look here, you'll see for Jetpack Joyride, it's giving me information. It says here, you know, you've collected 5 vehicles. It's constantly rotating and updating and letting me see information about the game before I even load it. So it's kind of nice. And there you've got Cut the Rope. It's saying that I have 6 stars so far. So it's always giving you a little bit of feedback and keeping you interested without actually loading the game. Let's go ahead and fire up Skull of the Shogun here. They have their splash screens here. Of course, branded with all the companies that worked with it. And then here we get into the menu. This is kind of like a hierarchical pattern mixed with a flat pattern. You have your sections, but they're laid out in such a way that all the information is readily acceptable. You don't have to scroll or anything, it's just right there. So, for instance, if I wanted to check my achievements, I can click my achievements here. Should load up, there we go. And it loads up another screen that shows me all my achievements. Currently, I don't have any, so I guess I better get on that and get some achievements. But yeah, it makes it easy for your players to find what they're looking for. If you can see here, I can scroll through, like starting a new campaign. When I click it, it takes me to a new screen and it brands it with a little bit different feel, so it kind of customizes it to the new game experience. So your users are getting kind of a feedback and it gives a nicer experience to the user. So that's basically Skulls of the Shogun's, the way they handle their menu system. So let's go ahead and take a look at another game here. Let's take a look at Jetpack Joyride. As you can see, they have a loading screen there, smashing high scores, it says. It just gives the user feedback, letting them know that your game is loading, and it's not crashed, it's coming. It's always nice to let the player know that you're not, you know, crashing or stalled or something along those lines. So with Jetpack Joyride, they've went with more of the flat design again. Here you can see it says touch anywhere to play. So I can immediately jump right into this game if I wanted to. I could just click the screen and away I go. I can start playing immediately. But if I want to check out other things, they have the list on the side. So if I want to check what missions are available to me, I can go ahead and click that. And it says your mission so far, and it pops out a little thing here. All the while keeping interaction going, you see the little guys moving around. It keeps you feeling like the game's running and you're doing something. So again, it's kind of like a loading screen only through the menu systems, right? So then if I click leaderboards, it'll go out and it'll download the leaderboards. So as you can see, there's multiple ways to handle the menu system. It really depends on what your game's trying to achieve and what kind of features are included in your game. So try to keep that in mind when you're developing. Exactly what is my game's key features, and what can I use to make it easier and more fluid for the average user to navigate. So let's go ahead and talk about gameplay interactions. What's a game with no input, right? So let's talk about a little bit about what Windows 8 has to offer in terms of interactions with the player and input. Some of the major points are touch interactions. Windows 8 supports multi-touch interactions, which means you can have up to 5 inputs on the screen at once. So you could do something like, you know, pan and zoom while shooting or controlling the player and camera. This opens up a lot of possibilities to the game developers and allows us to do things like virtual game pads on the screen. With 5 inputs, you're not really limited to what you can creatively do. So you could do things like invisible controls, like a D-pad or joystick. Not only does this add a nice layer of interaction, but it also cuts down on screen clutter. One of the things you want to do, though, when you do an invisible control is let the size be customizable. Make it relative to where it shows up for the player. So say I put my thumb down, have that where the joystick will show up, or at least let me customize it. You're never going to have a one-size-fits-all solution. Everybody's got different size hands, different size thumbs, so you want to make sure that you're allowing the user some flexibility when it comes to the inputs. Another big thing to watch out for is the default placement. Watch where you're holding the device. If you get too close to the screen edges, you're going to run into things where you're doing unintentional swipe commands. So I could be trying to move my player and move my thumb a little awkwardly, and if I'm too close to the edge, it might think that I'm trying to do a swipe command. So that's something that you really want to watch out for when you're developing your touch inputs. Okay, multi-input modes. When designing games, you should really try to target touch as well as keyboard and mouse and pen. Wherever possible, try to support all of these input methods. Your control screen should be very fluid and consistent as possible. If you're doing input switching, try to do it dynamically in real time so that the player's not experiencing some sort of lag in controls or stopping in the game and stuff like that. One thing, don't add settings to allow the players to turn on and off controls. If they want to use a mouse, let them use the mouse. If they want to use the touch, let them use the touch. But they should be able to decide on the fly and not have to go into the settings and change things, right? Ideally, your game should support all control modes seamlessly and equally without really having to switch modes. Okay, so app bar commands. App bar commands are basically used to for navigation and stuff. So try to design your game so the players, basically, everything they need to do immediately should be on the canvas. If there's additional commands that need to be used by the user every once in a while, they're going to expect them to actually be in the app bar. It's a philosophy and design principle of Windows 8, so your users are already going to understand that if they're looking for something that's not on the canvas, chances are it's going to be in the app bar. So, you know, that's one thing to think about. Another thing to think about is contextual commands. So if you're using a commands like this, have it depend on, you know, the user's location in the hub, or depending on what they've selected within the hub. For things like selections, go to the left of the app bar. You know, so if you've got other things, how can I put this better? If you have contextual commands, try to keep them to the left, because that's basically the design principle in Windows 8. If it's something that you're doing specifically in that screen, chances are all the information you're going to need and commands you're going to need are going to be on the left side of your screen. Anything that has, like, that are always there, like, say, starting a new game or maybe pausing the game, that should go on the right side of the app bar. It's basically the design principles, and it's what your users are going to expect when they're playing your game. So you definitely want to stick with that. Okay. When we're talking about the app bar, there's one question you should really ask yourself. Well, actually, two questions you should really ask yourself. Will this control be used frequently? And is this control crucial to the gameplay? If you answer yes to either of those questions, it may be a good choice to put that specific control on the canvas. This ensures the users won't become, like, frustrated with constantly having to go down to the app bar and bring up something that is being used over and over and over again. So the app bar should be for things that are very infrequent and not necessary to continue the game. Also, with the app control bars, you can personalize them and add some personality or branding to them. So there's a little bit of flexibility there as well. So I'm going to show you real quick. I'm going to demo a game called Cut the Rope. I personally like the way they use their menu system. So let's go ahead and take a look at Cut the Rope here. Now with Cut the Rope here, you'll see immediately it signs me in. But they've done a really good job of putting what's useful right on the screen. So for instance, options is right there. Your ability to turn on and off the sound is right there. They've kept it very minimalistic, but it's very good for showing exactly how simple a menu can be, but getting all the information to the player at once. The other thing that's really good about Cut the Rope is their input system. They have done a great job at touch input. So I'm going to go ahead and open up the game here and show you what I mean. So this is the entire menu system in the game. As you can see, I've got my stars up here that let me know how many I've collected. We've got something that tells me, you know, that lets me mute the sound. And then we have our restart button and our menu button. So they've put everything that you're going to need right on the canvas. But they've done it in such a way where there's not a lot of clutter. So this is a really good example of, if you need to put everything on the canvas, how can I do that without overwhelming the player? And of course, the touch inputs on this game are fantastic. It's very fluid, and again, I'm using the mouse. On a tablet, you could use your finger to swipe and cut. I didn't really do that time. you can really see where the advantage of touch comes into a game like Cut the Rope. So that's a really good example to take a look at if you're trying to decide how to use interactions with the player. Let's talk a little bit about sensors. Sensors are really fun for me personally. I like the ability to add a layer of dynamics to my game that I can't necessarily do on, say, just a PC platform or, you know, maybe some of the game consoles. So it really opens up a new world of interaction to us. We have things like the accelerometers, we have the compass, we have the gyro, light sensors, and a bunch of other things. So some of the examples you could do is, like, so say for an accelerometer, you could use it to, like, steer a car or tilt elements on your game. I'm sure a lot of you have played games out there that, like, you know, racing games that allow you to tilt your phone or your tablet to control the player's movements. That can be a really nice layer of interaction. You've got things, you could use the device's location sensors to determine, you know, how to rotate or turn your player or camera viewpoint. So if I move the device, the camera's, you know, turns a little bit. You can shake the device and get input that way. You know, maybe that's how you defeat an enemy or reset a game board in a puzzle game or something along those lines. Light sensors are great for changing like a mood or lighting of a game's rendering. So you can kind of get a feel of like if they're in a bright room, you could, you know, darken up the images a little bit, or if they're in a dark room, you could do, you know, some really big flashes of light and stuff to kind of like, you know, if you're doing a horror game, maybe to scare them or something. So it's really cool in that respect. Augmented reality is possible with these sensors. So you could, you know, do things like have a game where you're actually playing in your environment and have secret elements hidden right in the world. So that's really fun. So with things like sensor fusion that's built into Windows 8, it enables you precise orientation and location. So that is very important when you're doing AR, and can make a huge difference. And you're going to see a lot more AR games coming out as the technology really develops. So the possibilities are vast. While not all sensors make sense for your games, with a little creativity and thought, you can really come up with some clever ways to use them. Simple gestures or movement can replace a lot of menu commands. So yeah, take a good look at how you can best fit these sensors into your game. Okay, let's talk a little bit about contracts. Windows 8 uses contracts to really enrich the experience of your game. It allows us to connect with other apps on the platform, as well as the web and the world in general. So it's a really good way to enrich the experience of your game and add a really nice layer to the user experience. So we'll talk a little bit about search. Search can be really good for games. It's really interesting for games. It's one of those things where it may work for your game, it may not, right? So one thing that I've used in the past for search is things like looking up friends' statistics or standings, right? Or even trying to find a friend to play with. That could be a really good way to use search in your game. Another thing is if you've got, you know, a lot of in-game items, you might be able to use search to really look through them all and find the one that you're looking for instantly, instead of scrolling through a bunch and, you know, and using maybe semantic zoom in that. You could just search for it. So that's one way that you can really use search. Make sure you include the search in the charm, of course. That's where users are going to go immediately. And you'll see that they're generally going to start trying to search your game almost immediately to find some things. So it's always good to include at least a little bit of search functionality in your game. Now share. This is really good for gamers. It allows us to connect to social media outlets and friends. It allows you to post up, you know, something like a screenshot, even short clips of gameplay. With Facebook, you know, you could share achievements or your game status. It's a really good way to get social interaction for your game. And again, players are gonna automatically look to the share charm for some sort of functionality. So this could be really a really good way to help promote your game, as well as add some functionality to it. For example, sending a particular item in a role-playing game, for instance, to a friend would be a really good way of using a share, right? So I could open up my share charm, I could type in, you know, something like a hat or something, and I could share that with my player or with another player inside of a role-playing game. So that's one simple way, you know, to include share inside of the game, not just including it with the social media aspect. So yeah, definitely use this to get your title out there. It's definitely a good way to do that. Okay, let's talk about devices. Okay, so the devices charms. That's a really good place to put features like adding gamepads or other peripherals that you might have for your game. It allows the users, say, maybe to connect a larger screen. It's really interesting when it comes to games how you're going to use the devices, but there's definitely some key points that you can look at to really leverage the devices charms. One other thing that users are going to use the device charms for is printing. You're going to see a lot of users are going to go to that device charm, say to print out their high score table or something along those lines. So it's definitely a good idea to include some functionality with that as well. Okay, settings and options. All of your games' settings and options, privacy policy, about, even credits, help, everything like that should be accessible via the settings charm. Now I have shown you some of the setting or some of the demos there, and they have separate places to go to do your settings and options, but it's always a good idea to have it built into the charm too. You don't want the user to go to your settings and options charm and nothing be in there. It's a Windows 8 design philosophy that everything be there for the settings and options. So it's almost like you'd want to go there, implement all that first, and then if you decide to maybe add a menu command where you can, you know, change your settings, that would be okay. But it would be an after the fact. You definitely want to make sure that you're using the charms to the fullest, because again, that's where players are going to go. They're going to automatically look to your charms for the information that they're used to finding in other apps and other games. You might want to include something like a volume control in here too. Windows 8 provides a global volume control, but many games like to have their own more complex sound settings, you know, separating the music and sound effects and voices and stuff like that. If you do that, make sure you include labels that make it clear that the audio settings are specific to your game and not necessarily doing all of the Windows 8 at once. So that's one thing you want to look out for. Make sure that you clearly label what your settings are doing and in what context your settings are working. If your game includes something like a gameplay training or help, like a tutorial or something, this might be a good place to put the information. Stick that in your settings charm. Alternatively, you know, you could make the tutorials available part of your gameplay, which a lot of games are doing now, but it's always nice to be able to go to the settings charms and look up, you know, tutorials on how to use certain features of the game. So that would be a good way of using the settings and options in that context. All right, let's talk about a little bit about player accounts. Player accounts are very useful for video game designers. It's great for tracking players' progress through the game. It's great for having them link into social networks. It's also very important for enabling revenue models. By supporting player accounts, you're giving a more engaging experience to your player. That'll eventually, you know, that'll keep them coming back to play. They'll be able to, you know, keep track of their high scores and challenge their friends with this interaction. So it's definitely a good strategy to have in any game, especially if you're going to be doing in-app purchases. You definitely want to implement some sort of user sign-in and account management systems. So user sign-in, it's crucial to your game's experience that the user sign-in is dedicated up front. Like, you want it to be immediately. You don't want it... If they want to sign in, have them sign in immediately. If they don't want to sign in, don't have them make it so they can't play the game if they don't. When it's possible, try to use the sign information from a Microsoft account or from a cache sign information from previous sessions in the game. This is a good way to have the player tie into their social media. So maybe they can sign in with Facebook or they can sign in with their, you know, their live account. This is easy for them. They don't have to make another account just to play your game, and it keeps everything kind of in one spot. It's a really good idea when you're doing a user sign-in to dedicate some space on the hub or on the screen to show them where to sign in. You saw there when I showed you Cut the Rope that right off the bat it showed up at the top, says Scruffy Fern signs in, and it lets me know immediately that I've signed in, or allows me to click there and sign out if I don't want to be signed in. So make sure that it's visible and easy for the players to find. You don't want them having to go to hunting around to try to find out where they can sign in and where they can sign out. The setting panel comes into play here again too. It might be a good place to put the user's sign in and sign out experience, as well as account management would be a great place to put that in your settings charm. Your account management, you want to have it set up so that the player can, you know, say change their email address, change their passwords. You're going to want to do this all in the settings pane. Any sign-in experience they have should also be hosted in the settings site. So if I click in here, I should be able to, you know, update my info or just sign out. Make sure you're giving your players some sort of mechanism to adjust their settings, basically, when it comes to their account. Okay, so this brings us to state management and the cloud. State management is very important for games nowadays, and with the cloud, it makes that state management so much easier. It adds a level of continuity for your game across multiple platforms. Saving the user's progress is important. You can do things like checkpoints and save files. A lot of us are already used to that when we're designing games. You know, that's kind of like a given. You're going to want to have some point where they're going to save, whether they reach a certain level or what it might be. But one thing that you're really going to want to think about is the state of the game. If a game's suspended, you should pause that game, right? That game should transition to a state where it's not continuous, right? So that when I bring that game out of suspension mode, it should already be paused, or at least have some sort of meaningful feedback. If your game's not really a game that you can pause, it should allow you to know that you suspended and then have returned. if the app doesn't really have a pause menu, one thing you could really do is take them right back into the game immediately. But if you do that, you might want to include some sort of like countdown or a timer, so they're not just being thrown right back into the action, and it might catch them off guard and cause them to lose the game. So that's one thing you want to take a look at, it how you handle going to a pause state or a suspension state, and how you return from that suspension state. That's really important. Now with pausing, not every game needs pausing. Turn-based games, for example, there's really no need for pausing. Games driven entirely by a user, you know, without a clock or a timer, they don't really gain anything from having a pause feature. So pausing the game when they navigate away from the game isn't completely necessary, but it's a good idea to at least give them some sort of feedback on that. If it's not possible, for instance, like pausing in multiplayer game sessions, you don't really want the one player to be able to pause and hold up the rest of the game. So when you're building your game, you have to kind of take a look at it. Is pause going to make sense for what I'm doing? Is it a type of game where one player, if they pause, is going to hold up everyone? If that's the case, you might want to look at a different mechanism in ordering and for allowing players to, you know, to take a break or a breather. One thing you could do is like register a loss of focus. If the game disappears, have a dialogue box pop up or something and say, you know, this game has been suspended, it's now returning. And again, that goes into like the whole countdown and stuff. So definitely take a look at, you know, when you're snapping, your snap to and your snap from, that's a good time to take a look at pausing. A lot of games, because when you do the snap to, it changes your resolution and your format, it's a good idea if you don't have a mechanism in place to really allow the player to play the game while it's in snap view, maybe just including a pause would be the best solution in that case. So yeah, let's talk a little bit about the cloud now. The cloud really allows users the chance to play their game in multiple places. So imagine that you have this situation where you're playing a game on your PC, and you want to get up and say, go and play that at the table with your tablet. This is where the cloud comes in and is really a great feature. You could save all your game states and settings right up into the cloud. So you get this this continuous experience across multiple devices, whether it be a PC, a tablet, it doesn't matter where they are, they're going to experience that same experience, and they'll be able to pick up right where they left off, which is also a great feature. So when you're building your game, think about how can I include the cloud in my data situation. You know, how can I make it so that the players have the ability to save all their information up into the cloud and be able to pull it down in a way that they can continue their game no matter what device they are or where they left off from. So the cloud really opens up a great opportunity for us in multi-platform gaming. Okay, so this brings us to orientation and window size. Orientation and window size is kind of a tricky situation. A lot of times when you're developing games, you're not sure of the resolutions that the player is going to be using and whatnot. So let's go through and really think about how we could use orientation and window size in our games. In Windows 8, an app can have one of four visual states. It can have a full screen landscape, it can have full screen portrait, it can have snapped, or it can have fill. In order to get your game onto the store, you must support at least full, fill, and snapped. Optionally, you can have portrait and landscape. Those are optional, but you must support full, fill, and snapped. Be careful to maintain states when switching views. Like we were talking about before with the pause state situation. If I'm going to transition from one state to the next, whether it be full screen landscape or full screen portrait, snapped or fill, make sure that the user's experience is continuous. So if I move the device into a portrait mode, it should scale and change the formatting, but I shouldn't lose my point in the game. That's a big key. You don't want to, ruin the user's experience because they moved the device or they snapped it or changed it to a fill view. When you're in the fill state, your game should be playable and should simply just adjust. The fill state isn't much different than your full view. So, say you're snapping from a full screen to a fill view, it shouldn't look much different to the players. It should really keep a similar look and feel. When it comes to the snap view, though, this is where you're going to have to really scale the game. If you're going to make your game playable in snap view, you're going to have to deal with a few different things. First of all, you're in a lot tighter real estate when it comes to display, and also where you're going to put your user interaction, say like commands and stuff like that. You might have to actually cut those back in order to make it to look properly. You don't want to have it snap and then have a bunch of little icons all over the place, really cluttering it up and making it look unwieldy. So with a snap view, we'll get into this in the next few slides. The snap view is really good with for players that like to do multitasking. For instance, you might want to be reading, or watching a video or something and playing a small, simple card game or something in snap view. These things really come in handy for users that like to multitask. It's a great feature, and if you can find a way to make your game playable in snap view, I definitely suggest it. Alright, let's go ahead and move on to snap view. I'm going to show you, for instance here, this is the game called Cannonball. It's being snapped here, and as you can see, it's still playable, but all the elements have been resized to fit on the smaller screen. So the game's still the same game, it's still the same functionality, it's just been, minimalized to fit on the smaller screen. So that's a great example of how to make a playable snap view game. If I go ahead and here in the slides, I have an example from Cut the Rope where it's not playable. So what they've done is they basically said, if you're in snap view, you can't continue the game, but we're going to give you a little bit of feedback. So in this case, they've got a screenshot of the current level. They've got what level you're on overall, and then they have a button here that says continue. So if the user wanted to, they could click continue. It's going to unsnap and it's going to go right back into the game. So that's a good way to implement snap if you don't want the player to be able to continue playing, or it's not feasible for the player to be able to continue playing. It's just a good idea, just to pause it and give them the ability to continue when they see fit. So that's pretty much it for snap view. So let's move on to something else. Let's talk about accessibility. Now, a lot of times when you're building video games, you can really incorporate things for people that have a wide range of abilities and disabilities. So if you're building your game, try to reimagine it as from the point of view of a person with disabilities. How can we accommodate those players and allow them to have a fun experience in our game as well? Adding features for accessibility can make games better for everyone. Accessibility features are really easy to set up. And if you're going to do it, start off early in the design process. Try to think about this right from the very beginning. How can I design the game so that it's accessible to everyone? So let's go through here. I'm going to point out a couple of key design points. So if you're designing for someone with visual impairments, blind or very visually impaired users use screen readers a lot to help them navigate. So when you're developing your model for your game UI, think about how is it going to work with a screen reader. Your games must be, you must label these UI elements properly, like with a name, with a role, a description, a state, position, because when the screen reader goes through, these are the things it's going to be looking for, and it's the feedback that they're going to get. So make sure when you do build these UI elements that you go through and make sure they're named properly and they have all the information that they need. It's important to consider what your UI will look like with system-wide accessibility options on the ease of access settings. Are enabled. Everything's going to be bigger or maybe a high contrast mode, so you definitely want to think, how is this going to affect my game and what can I do to make it work? Designing for keyboard accessibility and alternative inputs. Keyboard is critical for users using a screen reader and for users who have alternative input mechanisms. Such as switch controllers or eye trackers. Make sure that all the UI elements can be navigated with the tab and arrow keys. This is really important. It's going to allow them to get through your system without struggling to find the proper keyboard controls. Make sure you make all your commands and controls accessible with keyboard shortcuts. This is very important for people that have keyboard accessibility and also inputs. For example, in Cannonball, the platforms can be turned with the arrow key, allowing the gameplay to be entirely playable with the keyboard input itself. So you don't even necessarily need any other input except for the keyboard. Okay, designing for auditory impairments. If your game makes uses of audio cues or speech to convey information that is necessary for the gamers, make sure you include some sort of subtitles. This is very important for deaf or hard of hearing users. You want to make sure that they're getting all the simple audio cues and speech as well. There should also be visual substitutes for audio elements. Say like, you know, if the mood of the game depends on the sound, have some visual cues in there as well that relate that mood. Don't rely solely on audio to develop the mood. This goes back to great game design development. You really need to balance everything. It shouldn't just be audio. It shouldn't just be lighting. It should be a mixture of the two. So make sure you have different ways of showing that. If you have multiple different sounds playing at once, have an effects and dialogue box pop up and provide separate volume controls for each, say, speech, music, stuff like that. So the players can really change that, and it'll help with their comprehension. All right. Designing for the cognitive impaired. Gameplay should allow for a wide range of difficulty levels and game speeds. You want to set this up so that everyone can enjoy your game. Could your game be played by someone who's learning to read? That's a great question to ask yourself. You know, don't make it so complicated that the average user and people with cognitive impairments can't pick it up and start playing right off the bat. One easy way to do that would be to, like, say, offer a sandbox or a free play mode that has, like, no time constrictions on it, and allows the users to really, you know, enjoy it without having constraints. So that's a good way of dealing with users that may have the cognitive impairments. That's a simple way. Okay, so that's pretty much it. Let's wrap it up. Windows 8, again, this is a really beautiful platform to develop your games for. It's really easy. It's very intuitive. The UI structure that the Windows 8 principles relies on, it's really nice because it removes the clutter, which is great for us game developers. We don't want a bunch of options all over the screen. We want you focusing on our game. These key features, if you go through them, they're going to help you expand your game, and you're going to really be able to use what we've talked about here to make your game stand out in the marketplace. So make sure you follow the advice that we've given you, and take a look at all the guidelines and principles that are available to you when you're developing for Windows 8. And I can't wait to see your games in the store. Thanks for watching, everyone, and we'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Thank you.